The center is not holding the modern self in a theology of adoptive identity. So that is kind of a mouthful. So I'm going to try to break it down and so that hopefully it's digestible and still has an overall arc to it, but then different components as well. So I guess the first thing, though, is what exactly isn't holding? And I want to attack that maybe first. What I simply mean by that is to get a larger context for understanding these questions of identity that we've been tackling. And my wanting to do that is to move it, or not move it away from, but to include or add a larger social or political framework by which we can understand these very kind of subjective questions about who we are and those identity issues, which are crucial, of course, that Dick did really well yesterday morning. But part of what I like to do is to try to frame it in as large a context as possible so that the changes that have been happening to our notions of identity are attached to changes that are happening outside the self, if I can put it that way. Okay. And so hopefully this will become clearer. And then I'll end, with time permitting, how the biblical foundation addresses these contemporary notions of identity. And in particular, it's an idea I've been working with for a while now on a spiritual adoption. And for the first time in maybe the last year and a half, I've been able to, I think, make some connections with this idea of how we are adopted into God's family as believers, so not biologically, right, but through adoption. And it seems to me that that can potentially speak into some of the identity issues that are floating around today, especially maybe the race one. But okay, so first, to help situate things, Confucianism. I'm not going to park here very long, but I just simply wanted to make a counterexample. So you don't have to know anything about Confucianism, but what I simply want to suggest is that basically it's probably still the most, I think, comprehensive worldview in East Asian cultures, which includes China, Japan, Korea, and also into Taiwan. Basically, it's all about order. How to order a society. Where do the individuals fit in that order? And naming those relationships precisely and then establishing a hierarchy. So basically, there are five. And from top down, ruler, subject, father, son, elder brother, younger brother, husband, wife, friendship. Friendship is the only equal relationship. The rest have kind of a hierarchical kind of relationship to them. So without getting into Confucianism at all, I'm trying to use that as a way of talking about their concern for how the individual can fit into a social scheme in order to establish an order so that society can run well. But China, like the West today, is in a crisis as well. So Wang Hongning is probably the chief political ideologue right now in the People's Republic, so I'm quoting from him. He's actually educated in the United States as well. But there are no core values in China's most recent structure because economic liberalization and the eradication of traditional beliefs has left only individualistic nihilism at the heart of Chinese society. And then from President Xi, a nation without spiritual strength will struggle to stand on its own feet. A cause without its foundation in culture will struggle to sustain itself over the long term. I apologize for my throat. I've gotten over a cold, but the voice thing is still there. So how does this disorder that is being perceived in China that they are grappling with and dealing with and engineering a solution in their own kind of way? Just so you know that this is kind of a universal issue at the moment. But to put it more in kind of our own Western framework, I'm going to draw from Francis Schaeffer, who, by the way, in the last year and a half, as these issues of identity have kind of escalated in the West, I've been really struck by going back to some of Schaeffer's earlier writings And I was particularly struck by the way it was used, I think, in Douglas's presentation as well. But it's shockingly relevant, you know, and I shouldn't be surprised. But it all of a sudden, all these issues about what is reality and all, it getting back to the Genesis accounts of creation in order to ground sort of sexual identity as well. I mean, these are... It's an interesting time for us. Okay, so Schaefer from Genesis in Space and Time. What differentiates Adam and Eve from the rest of creation is that they were created in the image of God. For 20th century man, this phrase, the image of God, is as important as anything in Scripture, because men today can no longer answer that crucial question, who am I? So, I mean, he is attaching a theological framework to ground these issues of identity, which I'll get to that hopefully at the last section as well. But I guess from where I'm coming from, I'd like to add not just the question of who am I, but where am I? Okay, so a question of what position do we occupy right now in modern societies to help explain or at least contextualize what's going on, like with issues about identity. So here's my outline. Okay. I'm riffing off a lecture by Dick Kies, Living in the Shadow of the Fall, but this is Modern Dilemma, Living in the Shadow of the Enlightenment. So I'll tackle that a little bit more. I feel that this is still kind of the space, the political space, the philosophic space that we inhabit, that the nations of the world also inhabit, and that part, I think a fairly powerful way of understanding some of the swings in identity that are going on and the extremes of it is by understanding a bit more of what this thing is, you know, what is the Enlightenment. So first is a philosophic framework. My main point is going to be looking at the divided spheres of knowledge, and I'll get to that in another slide. But by having basically all the things we think of as human experience, knowledge of art, morality, some more open kind of abstract philosophic questions as well about, you know, existence, that in the Enlightenment, these areas were considered totally unrelated and broken apart. And that they can't really inform each other. So that's what I mean by the divided spheres of knowledge. And what that did, because I think that's not a sane position, because human beings aren't divided that way, right? We're made up of all kinds of components. I think Dick, part of what I was getting from what he was saying about having multiple identities, he didn't say it that way, but that idea, is that it's untenable as a position, and it's untenable if you try to establish a political order that way as well, because you can't just cordon off, you know, the arts, religion in one area, and then the government, public space in another area, that there's going to be increasing tension. Okay? And hopefully this will become clearer over time. The way I come up with it is there's going to be a whipsaw effect between these spheres. As one region feels ignored and wanting to be basically appealed to, and then kind of overreacts against the other, you know, which is more the, if I can call it, the public space, governmental, drier, bureaucratic kind of organization of life. And then kind of this back and forth, kind of whipsaw or pendulum swing, if that's a better way for you to understand it. Related to that is number two, secularization. So the Enlightenment is a process of secularization. So moving away from a theologically informed and maybe even sort of theologically practiced way of social life into more of a secular one. Okay, so that's what I mean by that. But the main point is that it's not that the religious world goes away. Okay, so it's just being partitioned in certain sort of corners. It's sort of like the non-smoking kind of area or the smoking area in a, you know, in an airport. You know, like you go over there and deal in your world, but don't get in my lane. It's that kind of thing. But it doesn't go away. And so part, I think, of this process of Enlightenment, because it's, you know, if you put a date onto it, maybe 18th century early, it's taken a while for the logic of it to unravel and to unfold. But because it came on the heels, and I believe borrowed a lot from kind of a theological legacy, that it, the logic of it doesn't come obvious to be so obvious at first. But I think we're probably living in a time where it is kind of pretty obvious, like at this point. That's the open question of my presentation, you know, basically the breakdown of the Enlightenment as well. But I also have contemporary Enlightenment, because there are people, intellectuals, public figures, who are worried about kind of what they see as the unraveling of the Enlightenment. And for the most part, they're not Christians, they're not believers. But they're also, because they're concerned about what's happening to the societies that they love, that they're trying to find ways of counteracting what they see as kind of a threat to it. And I just rush a little ahead and say that that's kind of where I think conservative Christians especially, I think, are meeting in a kind of a middle ground with these contemporary Enlightenment figures, which is really, really interesting. Whether it can be successful, I think, is another question, but that's kind of, I think, where we are. So I've got some juicy examples of that I'll show you. But the biblical response, so again, the idea of spiritual adoption and how it might respond to the questions of sexual difference and also racial difference. Okay, so that was the introduction. Okay, here we go. So there's going to be quite a few quotes, so I'm going to warn you. Okay, I tried to edit them down, so it's not going to be like, you know, too painful. But the first one is a philosopher, and these, by the way, are across the board. They're not necessarily believers. They may. So I'm just drawing from, you know, all kinds of sources. So J.M. Bernstein's English philosopher wrote The Fate of Art. Modernity is the separation of spheres, the becoming autonomous of truth, beauty and goodness from one another, and they're developing into self-sufficient forms of practice, modern science and technology, private morality and modern legal forms, and modern art. And again, if you wanted to put a date on, I mean, this, especially the first few chapters, he kind of breaks it down philosophically, but going through, starting with maybe the 18th century, if you want a name to put on this, which I'm not going to even get into really, but as a philosopher, if you're taking notes, then Kant would be, K-A-N-T, would be probably the center, certainly for where J.M. Bernstein's analysis is, and where I increasingly have fallen into that camp as well. There are other figures, of course, but Kant seems to be the one mainly responsible for coming up with the theoretical apparatus to justify dividing into these spheres. Okay. So now just a little more. So this is my kind of home version of an outline. So what is Enlightenment? You know, which is tied to the question of what is modernity? Okay. So let me try to explain this. I'm doing it into kind of a binary. So this, because I mentioned three spaces, but you can also kind of divvy it up in two ways as well. And the main one is separate spheres. So on your left, it would be, I'm calling it under the private realm, the emotions, or a more accurate term might be sentiment, the areas of art, you know, as well as religion. So maybe this is cluing in already, so we're talking about separation of church and state. I mean, this is beginning to happen now. So basically, the authority is being wrested away from the church and being transferred to the state in the Enlightenment, at the same time that this philosophic work is also happening to separate things. The individual, okay, so we'll focus on the individual. I'll speak to this a little more, because we're probably getting away from the individual. I think other people, I mean, my title has self in there, and I'll explain that transition a little bit. And then Romanticism, kind of as a poetic movement, a literary movement. Then on the right-hand side, so what I'm calling the public space, right? And I think we're familiar enough with that kind of public-private kind of discussion, but the area of reason, science, definitely, and technology, you could slide in there as well. The role of society. So I coupled that with individual. So the individual exists, but it's also his or her role and position in the greater social world that comprises this whole system that they're trying to kind of sustain. And that public-private relationship As a political philosophy, I'm going to use the label liberalism. So this doesn't have to do with, you know, liberal versus conservative, but it's more a political philosophy. Basically, what you think of is modern nation states, democracies, the idea of the individual being able to function, to vote, make his presence known, that kind of exchange. That's the model. That's the ideal. That was the model and the ideal for the Enlightenment. And the crowning achievement of that was the nation state. Okay. I think, let me see. So I'll just throw in a bit of a crisis point here. So this is a very unstable situation. I mean, it's held together for quite a while. So, you know, but nevertheless, it's unstable for the reasons I was trying to explain before, that you can't totally separate these things. So the nation state is the glue, you know, the umbrella, so to speak, that's trying to hold everything together. But it can fall apart at different times as well. And so there's quite a bit, I think, of social criticism now that we may be living in one of those times where it's really being tested. And some people, you know, would go further than that, that maybe there's no more buy-in for this system, right? That it's beginning to lapse as an idea, you know. And I guess we'll just have to wait and see, you know, that, how that works. But nevertheless, that's the threat that it's under, I think. And I think that's legitimate. The other qualifier I want to make, too, is Enlightenment happened pretty much everywhere, but has a different flavor in different sort of parts of the world. So I'm not going to get into all the details. You can make a case that the Enlightenment in Europe was quite different, right, than the Enlightenment, the way it took form in America, which never had an official kind of state church. So the separations, that probably means something quite different in our context, if you're an American here. A simple way that's helped me to think about it is maybe in Europe the idea of separating the spheres had to do with protecting the state from the church. Okay? And just generally, simplistically to put it, maybe in the United States it was more to protect the church from the state. It had kind of that leaning on it. Okay. So this is... I have several slides here. I'm going to try to illustrate the first idea. What I mean by this is that in the Enlightenment, it had kind of a humanism, right? Putting man at the center as a pinnacle. But this overlapped a lot from the biblical idea of the image of God, like the Imago Dei. So I'm calling this the equality of sameness. So this vision of mankind as a unity, right, that everybody could belong to in the world. So it was a super idealistic kind of notion. I try to give some key points here. So humanity, kind of mid-20th century, kind of universal, is going to be displayed through a photo exhibition called The Family of Man that perhaps some of you may have even seen, but maybe you became familiar with it. It was touring America about 1953, but then went all around the world. So... I think something like 90 cities, 70 countries, maybe a total of 9 million people around the world is estimated to have been seen this exhibition. So considered the largest photo exhibition ever done. But it dovetailed with other things, like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is featured in the exhibition at the very end of the exhibition space. So, it comes at the end of the end of World War II, right? So a disastrous time for European civilization. So there's very much this idea of trying to heal and to reform itself. So I think that context is really, really important. It's already suffered quite a bit, right? This idea of the Enlightenment and humanism. So this has that kind of salvage mission to it, I think. So Family Man, and it started the Museum of Modern Art and then just traveled all around the world. So again, the equality of sameness, I'll bring this up later, but here's some of the themes. So you would walk into an exhibition space kind of like this, and basically they just had photographs of different themes of human activity, okay? But they went all around the world. There was a very kind of star-studded team of photographers that went around the world and just took pictures of people at different kinds of activities of their day. One was work. So a lot from Japan, but there were some from different cultures in Africa as well, and in India. Marriage. Grief. Also worship, or the sacred. The paternal, or mother-child relationship was featured as well. Friendship. And then ended with this UN Charter, which I'm going to read. We the peoples of the United Nations determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations large and small. So very much this very grandiose or humanistic vision. So through all those kind of photos that you may have looked at for a while, that idea of showing that man is really one, right? No matter where you are, we're all kind of the same, you know. And so I'm suggesting that that was maybe near the end of the last gasp of that vision of man, that he was a unity. Okay. And then, but what I more recently learned in researching the UN Charter was the overlap with the Imago Dei, the idea of the image of God, is not an accident, right? So apparently there were some Catholic theologians that were tasked to draft the UN Declaration, right? The main one was Jacques Maritain. What was criticized was this theologian he took out basically all the God language, right? And then just tried to create something that could be more palpable to a general world without having to reference kind of any kind of biblical or theological framework, okay? And here's a more recent Catholic theologian, philosopher, that kind of addresses that idea of secularizing the image of God. During the Second World War and throughout the post-war, an individualistic account of human dignity increasingly served as a political concept, which could be used by Christians and atheistic humanists alike as a neutral concept, which could be used with or without reference to God. And after, you know, I read through this person's work, one particular essay, I began to think about it more and thought, yeah, I guess I was guilty of that too, right? So I tended to just think of the Imago Dei as this static quality. And I don't want to undermine the idea of there being an essence, so that's not where I'm going with this. But I think there's a dynamism as well to being it, whereas the criticism here is basically you're lifting a concept out of its kind of theological context. So there is a direction in the Bible. You know, man is created, there's fallen, and then there's a plan of redemption, then you have judgment. You know. So there's a whole end or telos purpose to this Imago Dei. So if you just try to extract something that sounds kind of good in terms of just more the idea of human dignity, whatever, I think you're at risk of losing kind of the whole system, like how it all fits together. Okay. I have another example of kind of this overlap of the secular enlightenment and theology, and this is a more recent example. Okay, so this professor, Gayatri Spivak, is at Columbia University, so I'm not going to go into her writings so much in detail. Her main, I think, famous point is that she's the one that translated Derrida's Of Grammatology, you know, into English. And then she wrote a very important introduction to grammatology as well. But I remember I would, when I was at Cornell, I would listen to various lectures that they sponsored, and she would come a fair amount. And I was really struck, because this was in the heyday of deconstruction and postmodernism, so kind of high theory, kind of in the university. But she was saying that the Enlightenment phrase, the idea of we the people, and the Enlightenment kind of orientation altogether for politics was really nothing more than a Christian metaphysics that was souped up into secular terms. So she was distancing herself from kind of the theological framework by saying that, I think. But she was also seeing the need to maintain that framework. And she would often talk about it as not forever, but just in the short run. You know, for political purposes, pragmatically, we want to be Enlightenment people and, you know, hang on to that. But we don't want to maintain this framework, you know, forever. We just want to use it practically. So it's a kind of a selective kind of choosing of what part you're going to take and what part you're not going to take. So that's part of, and part of, I think, what's going on here. Yeah. And yeah, I think I'll leave it at that. But I mean, this was probably what, in the early 1990s. But at a certain point, I think the center is no longer holding, right? So the whole, and maybe we're living at one of those times. So, and I realized that it's kind of like breaking of a dam or just the ungluing, I don't know, whatever metaphor or phrase you want to use to help explain this. I just ripped up the sheet of paper and took a picture of it. I mean, this idea of trying to illustrate, you know, visually kind of what's going on. And every metaphor, you know, has a limit to how successful it can run, but I think you're getting the idea, right? So the idea that whatever this larger system was that held things together, probably the nation state is the biggest kind of organization that represents this philosophy, that seems to be coming under pressure, and maybe even at a break point. And I guess the last caveat I'll say is probably depends a little bit on region and geography. I mean, it's going to be different for urban areas than in the country, but all those areas are still under the same nation state, so you can't get away from it. Okay. One way to illustrate this is a very famous quote by Justice Kennedy on the Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision in 92. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. So it's almost like a gift from God that he gave this kind of statement that so clearly states, like, you know, kind of really the logic of this position, right? But the idea that whatever we now call, he's still using, I think, a concept of individual, but it's now so detached from anything around that all the meaning that's generated is totally from the interior self, right? I think that's the main point here, but okay. I'm going to try to tie this in just briefly now. So, of course, a lot of us are at least familiar with some of the ideas of Carl Truman. So, and I'll admit, I didn't read it that carefully, but I did read it fairly carefully, and it seemed to me that he was doing kind of a history ideas kind of analysis and focusing a lot on the left-hand side. He did kind of go into some applications into the LGBT movement and this kind of thing, which was really interesting to me. But and in particular, he's looking at, I think, the last two, the individual, which he's calling the self, and then the romantic movement, like in poetry and philosophy as well. So if that helps you that are more familiar with Truman, I mean, that's kind of what I'm working with as a way of plugging him into this kind of system. But again, I mean, I think this is really valuable work, but my burden is I don't want to just get stuck with an analysis of everything that's going on by focusing on individual people. Like, I want it to be a larger system in order for this to really make sense to me of what's happening. Okay, it's a very important role, so I'm not undermining this at all. But and maybe there's a book out there that's done this, right? But the idea of trying to look not only at the changes in the interior self, which basically breaks down into a smaller realm until it almost totally collapses on itself, I think is one way of summarizing him. But I'm trying to focus on this other self as well. Okay. One way of helping to illustrate this is what some people are calling, you know, successor ideology, if you've heard of that, but what this critic, N.S. Lyons, is calling the new faith. So it's what they're describing is this incredibly dramatic transformation that's been occurring in the last few years that's just breathtaking. Virtually, I think, every elite institution in our society has now given over to this, whether you call it wokeism or however what you want to talk about it, you know, whether it's in the arts, whether it's in government, whether it's in the universities, in education and more generally. So it this kind of pervasive thing, and we're in the middle of it now. No one really even knows what to call it, really. So it's kind of live. This is happening right now, and this is one of the clearer articulations of it I've seen. The new faith rejects nearly every fundamental principle of liberal modernity, the existence of an objective and immutable reality that can be discovered by reason, the scientific method, an enduring human nature, impartial equality before the law, secular pluralism, and the value of freedom of speech, the separation of the private and political spheres. Liberalism has thus acted as a centrifugal force, severing all the counterforces that once kept individuals connected to human communities and launching them outward towards solitary orbits where they can drift cold and alone in their pods. So I like that image, you know, of what's people being kind of thrown out there. I think I need, excuse me, drink of water. But there's a response to all this. And so this is what I mean by the contemporary Enlightenment figures. And I'm also borrowing a term that Schaeffer, I don't know if he coined it or just used it, but the idea of co-belligerent, you know, the idea of not really like an ally, but choosing to work with people over certain specific issues, but not adopting wholesale the entire position, you know. So it might be feminists against pornography or something that Christians might find a way to work together with. But anyway, so, and I don't, there's not a whole lot working together at this point yet, but there's kind of the beginnings of it. So I decided to kind of throw that in there, okay. So what struck me though, and this individual here, he's an evolutionary biologist. So Reality's Last Stand is kind of this organization that he founded. So it so much rings with all the kind of early Schaeffer writings that appeal to reality, you know, not being able to walk through walls, and you know, that kind of appeal to sort of common sense, the idea. So let's get a little bit into Colin Wright. And he works a lot with the idea of sexual difference. Denying the reality of the two sexes, male and female, in humans is the absolute pinnacle of science denial. The biblical story of Adam and Eve is more scientifically accurate on this topic than the mainstream American left-wing media. Many atheists laugh at the Catholic belief in transubstantiation, that a cracker can turn into the blood and body of Christ, yet somehow take seriously the notion that a person by mere self-declaration transforms into the opposite sex. So, now I am going to say, so these people are fighting more kind of on an activist level. So they're not kind of in a lobby, community, hospitality, forming understanding with the other and, you know, forming these relationships. So some of these quotes are going to be pretty hard hitting. I mean, it's because that's kind of the level that they're dealing with. That's an important work, I think, that needs to be done. And probably could be done, you know, in a less nasty way as well. But there's also this other kind of community building idea, you know, of making bridges. But and I'll just list, I mean, there's dozens of these people out there. And again, he's a scientist. Some of the two more interesting ones for me are Melissa Chen, who's also a biologist, and then Sam Harris, who's a neuroscientist. They work in different organizations. I'm just going to mention Melissa Chen because she does really interesting stuff. So she has a Methodist background that she's distanced herself from now. She's from Singapore, was educated at Harvard, and has kind of given her life to these battles that I'm describing. One thing that she's done is she created an organization called Books Without Borders, and she actually has her friends like Steven Pinker or Sam Harris or whatever, these Enlightenment figures, she's gotten them to be willing to release the rights so that she could translate or have their books translated into Arabic and then make it downloadable for free, like in the Arab world. That's part of what she does. She's also very big in an organization formed maybe, what, 2 or 3 years ago? FAIR. It was like the Foundation Against Intolerance and Racism. So they're trying to create like a new kind of a ACLU, if that makes sense to you. So the striking legislation, or the lawsuit rather, that they've just undergone is, I think, suing parts of the city of New York for discriminating in terms of granting of hospital care, for depending on whether, you know, by racially, using racial determinations, whether someone should be placed at the top of the list for care or next or next or next, you know. And there are a few places where that kind of decision was made, and so she went ahead and it's a lawsuit. I don't know where it's at this moment. But Sam Harris, I'm not going to talk too much about him. He's one of your more famous of the kind of contemporary atheists. But he, like some of these others, though, they're kind of friendly to spirituality, I would say. So he's really popular with his meditation app, which he created, which friends of mine that do it love it. And they, you know, but so it's kind of a friendly relationship or an easier relationship with religion, but it's not necessarily Orthodox or what we would consider Orthodox Christianity. Okay. But what's curious is that a lot of these people are scientists, actually. So I have actually a short video clip I'm going to play of this next group. It's a husband and wife team, both evolutionary biologists, kind of nerdy a little bit. I think you'll kind of get that. So there's understanding social trends going on and putting them kind of in evolution biological kind of, you know, models that they use. But, okay.
The sort of phylogenetic relationship between Christianity and Judaism and the cultural, effectively the cultural borrowing of some of the so-called liberal ideals from the teachings of Jesus by the vast majority of people who call themselves secular liberal, which includes, I think, a majority of Jews, at least in America, that you and I, to some degree, come from these two different traditions as well, right? That you, you can speak in, you know, a couple of sentences about the home that you were raised in, but I was raised mostly about religion, but my father was a lapsed Catholic who, not as it turns out on his deathbed, but at one point when we thought he might not come out of open heart surgery, did ask actually to see a priest and talk to him, which as far as we know he hadn't done for, you know, decades. And so he, a man of science, a man of reason, a man who prized enlightenment values, was in some ways a man of faith as well. And although he took me into a church, I believe once and only once, to see the midnight mass one Christmas Eve, and so, you know, never took to me the faith that he was raised with on a, you know, on a farm in northeastern Iowa in the 40s and 50s. It was part of how he was, how he informed his own view, and my mother also emerges from the Christian tradition, although had no, was not raised with any faith herself, and they did not raise me with any. And
so for my part, I was raised in a home that was decidedly secular. Both my parents are Jewish, but it was, you know, there was ceremonial observance, but nothing based on faith, I would say. Mm-hmm. And that went back, you know, a couple generations on my mom's side. But my best friend growing up actually was in a Jewish home that was observant and kept kosher and I think believing. And so anyway, I got exposure to it that way, among others. So anyway, I think...
Okay, so Brett Weinstein, I'm just going to briefly describe him. So he had kind of a prophetic voice in terms of, he's most known for, he and his wife were professors at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. And maybe you know the story, but there was a campus day that no whites were supposed to be on campus. And he decided, I mean, he's Jewish, and he decided that was racist, so he wasn't going to stop teaching, and he was going to appear. So he did, but what was kind of strange and scary about the situation is it became kind of mob rule and anarchy on the campus. So, I mean, there were kind of these crowds, these thugs looking for him, where he was teaching, and we don't know what would happen to them if they found him. But, and in the end, he found some private, you know, obscure place to hold his classes the entire semester. But the prophetic part was what he said is, you know, and this was maybe, what, 7 or 8 years ago, I think, what's happening here is not going to stay at Evergreen. This is going to leave Evergreen, and it's going to filter into the rest of society as well. Just watch. So that was kind of what he became known for. What I'm interested in as well is this discussion of kind of their, it's kind of interesting. I mean, they're both, in this podcast, they're sort of trying to find some religious connection in their personal stories, right? And like, well, I was kind of raised this way, and I mean, you're Jewish. And, you know, they're trying to find some connection. And the thing that's motivated this is this book, Live Not by Lies by Rod Dreher. So who is an Orthodox? I mean, he was Methodist raised and became Catholic, I think, and then now is Orthodox. But that episode that I took the clip from was an entire episode devoted to Rod Dreher. And so they're, in their own way, trying to find some intellectual larger space that they can feel comfortable with, that, you know, we and Rod are kind of on the same page, you know, with this kind of thing. So it's an intriguing development to me. And then as an aside, I mean, you might know him more for the book The Benedict Option. And then I think some people tended to react against it, thinking maybe he was being escapist, you know. I didn't feel that way. But nevertheless, I think history is playing out more in his favor, in that he is probably one of the only, or maybe the most prominent Christians that is now read by secular atheist scientists, right, who are fighting on this issue. So he's definitely engaged in cultural issues in his own kind of way. So now I've got a few slides. I'm going to speed it up because I want to make sure I get through. One of the striking developments in the last several years is the rise in prominence of a unique cluster of Black public intellectuals. I mean, it's pretty striking, actually, what's happening. And I just got four at random I picked, and I don't have time to go into each one of them. Starting from your left, so that's John Wood Jr., who's based in Los Angeles. He has an organization called Braver Angels. He ran against Maxine Waters, actually, several years ago in Los Angeles County for Congress. But he's trying to bring both parties together on both extremes, you know, conservative and liberals, and is using marriage counseling as a kind of a strategy. That's kind of how he foresees this thing, taking two parties and bringing them together. Anyway, Coleman Hughes, very brilliant, young, maybe the youngest one here, a philosophy student from Columbia. I think I'm just going to leave it at that because I can race through. Glenn Laurie, the older senior of this group. So he's the first African-American PhD in economics at Harvard. And he's 70 now, but he's speaking out quite boldly against what we used to call political correctness. But, you know, he's not holding back at all, and he figures he's at the stage in his career where he doesn't care, kind of basically what happens to him. So the fellow that he partners with quite a bit is John McWhorter. So he's a linguist by training. Is a professor at Columbia as well, and he does quite a bit of speaking, and is probably one of the more prominent of these figures to be kind of mainstreamed, so you might even see him on a talk show now. You know, Coleman Hughes a little bit as well, okay. But what all these Black intellectuals and many others are trying to appeal to is the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., right? Let's get back to King. The civil rights movement, that approach, you know, to fighting racism. So what's interesting to me, though, is that, I mean, John Wood is a believer, a fairly new one. Glenn Laurie, he had converted later in life, but it doesn't run too deep, I would say, in their work. So the difference to me with a lot of this newer generation of Black intellectuals is they want to go back to King and civil rights, but they don't have kind of the church framework that animated and thing gave voice a lot to what that movement was about. So these are just snippets from the March on Washington. Really, they were having church outdoors. Okay, so there are men dressed in suits, ladies in dresses. King specifically wanted Mahalia Jackson, probably the most famous gospel singer in history, but to sing a couple of favorite hymns, and then he preached, right? It was that kind of thing. And it's just not clear to me that Can you just lift part of the legacy and not take the whole package? I mean, so it's very much like Gayatri Spivak in a way, right? Taking, well, the parts of the Enlightenment we like, but then we're just going to use it for a little while, then discard it. And so and these people are beginning to voice those concerns, some more than others. Like, can we really do this? We don't believe in any of this stuff. You know, it's interesting to see that, but. Okay, and then this is maybe the most grandiose recent experiment that was just announced several months ago. I was at a conference where they were talking about it. It had just been announced the night before. But they started in a university, okay, in Austin, Texas. So I'm going to read the bottom part from the founding president. We are done waiting for the legacy universities to write themselves, and so we are building anew. It's, you know, and then you think, that's a big project. Like, how are, you know, not... We're just not sure, but they've got a very illustrious board of trustees and advisors, from former president of Harvard, Larry Summers, to journalists like Andrew Sullivan. There are some really strong believers in this group as well. So they're trying to find, you know, they're acknowledging, because we have to somehow, we're Enlightenment people basically, but we have to figure out how this works with, you know, with those who profess a religion. The bottom right, Joshua Katz, so he's a classicist at Princeton, a new convert. I met him at this conference, and he was excited to be a part of this thing. Barry Weiss, excuse me, is probably one of the main voices for this, if that rings a bell for you anyway. But let me go on. Now, so it's hopeful, but you're just not sure, right? It's a huge venture. They're piloting a launch this summer, actually, for just a short kind of workshop-y kind of situation, and then go into a graduate school. And then the year following, 2024, they want to start an undergraduate college. And it's an on-site campus, right? But my understanding is a lot of donors are coming through for this, so we'll see what happens. However, there are significant naysayers to the whole thing. And I'm kind of drawn to that. So that's this is Yoram Hazoni, a very interesting Israeli political scientist who was trained at Princeton. Very active in a lot of the kind of these movements. But he sees very clearly that if you don't have a foundation, this isn't going to work. You're trying to get back to the liberal model of, you know, public sphere, because that was also part of the problem. Right, the dividing of the spheres like that. So you're just going to reinvent the same problem. So anyway, Hazoni, classical liberalism has never existed on its own steam anywhere. Throw out nationalism and religion, and classical liberalism collapses, as we're seeing now. In 2020, the hegemony of liberal ideas collapsed. And everyone, liberals, conservatives, Marxists, authoritarians, knows it. When the hegemony of one ideology comes to an end, the competing ideas feel more powerful and sound much louder. So he's an interesting guy to watch. I won't get too much more into his kind of strategies and whatever, but he's definitely theorized all this. But I'm going to shift now from kind of this political kind of public space discussion and just insert a very brief discussion into two other areas that I think are very, very important. And honestly, I don't know if we've covered these in the conference yet, but of course, you know, we're law breeze, so we're talking about history of ideas and philosophy and doing and that kind of thing. Kind of distilling movements, you know, by idea forms that they can represent. But there's also just technology, right, that's happening. So I'm just going to introduce this one fellow, Tristan Harris, or Tristan, I think is the way he pronounces it. So he was involved in Facebook. He's one of these Silicon Valley people. And I'm proposing that the collapse of public and private space, you may be familiar with a film that he came up with a little while ago called The Social Dilemma. Anyway, I recommend it. Anyway, it goes into kind of Facebook and algorithms and troll farms and all this kind of stuff. But anyway, here's Harris. Never before in history have 50 mostly male, 25 to 30-year-old designers living in California, working at three tech companies, influenced how a billion people spend their time. When you think about social media, you think information hub, but it's actually about meaning and identity. People are getting meaning and purpose from this thing. And he's mostly talking about phones, you know, and some of the social media apps. So that's a tremendously interesting thing. I mean, that's in my own experience with social media, that was one of the first things I thought, because, wow, there's no public space. Everything's collapsed. People are just talking about interpersonal thought. But like, there's no border anymore. Like, there's that whole thing has collapsed. It's really, really interesting. And, you know, we raised teenagers, and so we've seen that happen, you know, with, you know, like iPods and messaging and how it could be used socially to form groups and bully one another. And so as a basic summary, I think, of Harris's thesis is he's saying that same dynamic that happens like in middle school or high school for kids is now worked itself into the culture at large. And so you've got not just friends, you know, or are you into basketball or wear my tennis shoes, but political labels, political tribes, that kind of thing. So that it's an interesting kind of thesis. Just one example. So, and this was actually something he cites quite a bit, but it's from a tech journal called Technology Review. As a result, he's talking about social media, in October 2019, all 15 of the top pages, and this is on social media, targeting Christian Americans, 10 of the top 15 Facebook pages targeting Black Americans, and 4 of the top 12 Facebook pages targeting Native Americans were being run by troll farms. And through this article, they were actually able legally to try to shut down some of this activity. But there's a total of maybe 17, and only one is not basically being produced by robots, right? And so he discusses like what this has done, because now they know how to create these news feeds, how to feed articles, how to actually create news. And of course, they're computers, so they can do it really, really rapidly, right? So, okay. So that I have just an analogy. Okay. So if Godzilla is, you know, the monster nightmare that comes out of the darkness, like Tomoyuki Tanaka says, you know, with nuclear power, a nuclear disaster, then maybe the internet represents the cyber tribal monster. You know, so, and this is a kind of a techno kind of analyst philosopher. He died a few years ago, Paul Virilio. He's French. I agree with what Einstein used to say about the two bombs. The first one is the atomic bomb, which disintegrates reality. The second one is the digital or computer bomb, the information bomb, which destroys the principle of reality itself, not the actual object. He's really good at coming up with these kind of, you know, controversial statements. But anyway, so that I'm all clumping in the one area under maybe the sub-theme of tribalism and how the internet seems to be fostering this. So out of the swamp of the internet, you know, arises now these sort of, you know, tribal monsters now. But okay, and then to help illustrate the tribalism, quoting from an author in a fairly new journal, I think it's only been around a year, called Journal of Free Black Thought. And this is John O'Hara. And this, remember when I talked about the equality of sameness with the family man, those photographs? So now I think at a certain point it's shifted to equality of difference with identity politics, which actually, you know, when we think about it, it's pretty oxymoronic. Like, identity politics really represents a collapse of politics, at least the way we understand it, and kind of in modern liberal societies. So just from this quote, blackness with a capital B, or can everybody be a star? BLM's essentialist challenge to liberal humanism. The cultural understanding of the very term black, lowercase, is itself shifting from describing a racial ethnic minority that is historically participated in and often led to a broadly American struggle for emancipation to an essentialist subgroup now beginning to situate itself outside the historical framing of the pursuit of liberty and equality in the US. This is a change, in other words, from black to black, a capitalization that reflects a change in the view of the historic naming of America, meaning of America, and the relationship of its citizens to that history. I'm just going to cruise along here. Okay. So this just has one slide. So the technology was the main additional kind of framework. The other is the sociology, Catholic sociologist from Stanford, Mary Eberstadt. A few years ago, she published a book called Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. So at its most fundamental, the vote by much of Western humanity to live without a transcendental horizon, in other words, a transcendent deity, removes one more way of answering the question, who am I, that religion has traditionally supplied. I am a child of God. So now she does quite a bit of interesting kind of field work in looking at the changes in the family setup as a way of trying to explain some of the things that are happening. So I would say she has a sympathetic reading of what we now think of as kind of, some people disparage, as kind of the hysteria that you, college campuses, some became famous for. You know, people were protesting, being triggered. And I don't know if you've seen any of these videos, but I mean, it's quite, you know, emotional, right? It's not just, you know, just irritated or something, but it's, so she's trying to give a sympathetic read of that. Like, instead of totally dismiss these people as snowflakes, their sociology may have something to say about why they came to this place. Okay. And then, okay, so I think I have just some time to go into kind of a squeezed-in biblical foundation here. Yeah, just the way it always is. Okay. So I'm calling it the biblical response, the stakes of sexual and racial identity. But I'm framing it by using another social critic. I really love his work, Wesley Yang. He has a Methodist background as well, and that's why he's named Wesley. But what's interesting is, you know, he has a daughter, and he's beginning to say, you know, he traces his own lineage and his upbringing and says, what I received from my family, I can't give to my daughter. I don't believe these things anymore, right? So he's an atheist at this point. But I can see the need for her to have the background that I grew up in. But how do I bridge this impossible gap, right? So he's voicing this concern, I think, more explicitly than most. But anyway, but the other reason I'm kind of using him is he seems, on an activist level, really to understand what's at stake, so in terms of the gender stuff. So a primary constraint that the gender ideologists now hold responsible for much of the world's oppression and violence is the binary structure of the sexes and the division of the world into male and female. Overcoming this division is an essential part of the, quote, abolition of all forms of oppression and violence. And that those who even hesitate to embrace this agenda are rightly comparable to slaveholders, gay bashers, Southern segregationists who screamed and threw garbage at children, integrating Southern schools during the Civil Rights Movement. So he's doing a lot of research into these various movements. Something just happened. Yeah, okay. And being able to, what was interesting to me is he tied it to the sexual difference. Like he put it there. So that really has to be torn apart. From his reading of these activists, as a way of justifying change across the board. So this is kind of an interesting point. So let's get to the biblical. And I think this is, I don't know if anyone's already quoted this, but from Genesis 1, then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. So God created man in his image, own image, in the image of God, he created him, male and female he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. So there's a lot, of course, more you could talk about this. The only thing I'm really drawing from this, a couple of items, is the unity and plurality that's in the God himself, right, in the Trinity, the plural, the let us make man in our image. So if we're made in the image of God, then on some level we are portraying or mirroring that unity balance. Something's attacking me. Okay. Okay. Oh, I'll hurry and get through this. The other thing I wanted to also put out there, though, is, do you remember I was talking about a criticism of the image of God being seen as a static kind of thing? So here, I tend to just stop at the image of God. He created him and think about things like creativity or communication or whatever. But it goes down to actually generative or reproduction, right? And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So I think you can't really separate those two out, right? That they're connected. And I'm going to suggest that there is this forward motion, this kind of advancing movement in the narrative in general in Genesis and most of the Bible too. The fact that there's evening and then morning, right? So as opposed to having kind of a morning and then evening, like it's propelling the narrative forward, like to covering 2 days as opposed to We can unpack that more later if you want. But if this is helpful to you, kind of a medieval emblem of the image of God. So some of you may be familiar with this. So I love this one. The shield, the idea of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, like in the corners, and then God in the center. And so across the corners, you know, the Father is not the Son is not the Spirit is not the Father. But then they meet, right, in the middle. And then Father, Son, Holy Spirit are God. So that kind of unity and diversity, which I think visually is really striking, like in this particular emblem. And so there's something of that kind of unity and difference that is there in the image of God for male and female as well, right? I think you need three to have a really good emblem, though, so I'm not quite sure how that works here. But nevertheless, it's the idea. Okay, so, okay. And then I'll bring in Roger again. In classical Christian teaching, the divinely sanctioned union of male and female is an icon of the relationship of Christ to his church and ultimately of God to his creation. Okay, so in the remaining time, I'm going to talk a little bit about spiritual adoption and try to make a tie-in with this as much as I can. So I don't know how much to presume, but so Abraham, Father Abraham, is considered kind of the patriarch, right? Not just in terms of the Old Testament, but through the Abrahamic covenant to encompassing the New Testament believers as well. I think, Romans chapter 4 is entirely devoted to Abraham, right? So it's kind of a theological logic for how we as Gentiles are brought into this family of God. And we're not obviously part of it biologically, but we become part of God's family through the principle of adoption. Okay, okay. So that's the main thrust. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I've made you a father, a multitude of nations. So again, the idea that Abraham's legacy is going to be fulfilled by this principle of grafting in the Gentile world into the Jewish one. And out of Romans 17, but if some of the branches were broken off and you, although a wild olive shoot, were grafted in among the others, and now share in the nourishing root of the olive tree, do not be arrogant toward the branches. So I'm beginning to now see the metaphor of grafting as an adoption metaphor, right? The idea of taking something from somewhere else and inserting it, and then becoming something new. I find that really powerful, you know, so I'm working with that. I'm kind of playing with this a little bit right now, but the idea of even, you know, Christ's striking statement to Nicodemus, who was Jewish, right? Saying, you must be born again, right? I'm thinking, that's an adoption statement. Okay, you know, that there's something going on there. Okay, so just a little bit more with Abraham. There's a lot more you can say about Abraham, but I'm just going to look at circumcision. And God said to Abraham, this is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your offspring. You shall be circumcised, every male throughout your generations, born whether born in your house or bought with your money from any foreigner who is not of your offspring shall surely be circumcised. So what I love about this is even with the practice of circumcision, it accommodates the non-Jew. Right? So there's a sense in which these different groups are made into one. Okay, and blended. So again, that's where I'm getting kind of the grafting idea. And then from someone who sometimes speaks to these conferences, Timothy Paget, slaves in biblical Israel were physically identical to masters. Even those slaves who were not born Israelites were to be Hebraized, made into Israelites through circumcision, and then fully invited into the social and religious life of the community. The blessings of God's promises to Abraham were applied to those so engrafted into his family. So again, what I love about this is it's the creation of a family through non-biological means, so to speak. What was interesting to me, I mean, because there's a whole history of anti-Semitism kind of in Europe as well, before the modern period, but apparently there was an out for them in that you could convert to Christianity. Okay, but once in the modern period, race becomes biologically defined, you can't get out of that. Like, it's inescapable, right? So there's no way to sort of be anything else. Like, you are trapped in your skin, so to speak. I mean, that's kind of how. And so that's what, of course, you know, prefiguring the Holocaust and that kind of racial logic, right? It's interesting how this can maybe be applied. One way I'm going to apply it now, and then this will be over, is thinking about how does this maybe pertain to not just, you know, Christians or Gentiles being grafted into the kingdom of God, but more culturally. So I'm going to borrow from Albert Murray. I can't really say too much about him right now, but a significant Black writer, scholar. He was himself adopted, so I think that's probably partly what informed him. But he came up with this concept of the omni-Americans, and basically holding on to the idea of having a mixed identity, and that's who we are. Those who are so deeply and fervently concerned about the status of Black culture are likely to be motivated by forces and precedents not nearly so African as European, or Euro-Talmudic, as it were. It is all too true that Americanization process that captive Africans were forced to undergo stripped them of many of the native accoutrements that they held most dear and wished to retain, but it was also a process of Americanization that has now equipped and disposed them not only to reclaim and update the heritage of Black Africa, but to utilize the heritage of all mankind, of all the ages. So I'm sorry, you know, I kind of read through that very, very quickly, but what the kernel that I'm getting at is this ability to recognize that just because you're whatever, Black, Asian, you're not limited to that biological racial definition. You have an entire other cultures that you can adopt, right? So whether it's Henry Louis Gates Jr., of what he started the African American Studies program at Harvard, talking about what's wrong with having, you know, white people write about kind of the legacy of slavery, right? And I can write about the Odyssey. I can write about Shakespeare. Who's to stop me from doing that? Like, what are we talking about? So I'm kind of interested in this kind of realm. And maybe I'll try to close here. Let's see how far I get. I've got like 3 minutes. This was a conference, a virtual conference I participated in last fall that brought together prominent African-Americans and Jews to try to fight anti-Semitism. So they called it Combating Racism and Anti-Semitism Together. Wynton Marsalis was mentored by Albert Murray. Actually, I think Albert Murray was the one that founded the Jazz kind of institute at the Lincoln Center that now I think Wynton Marsalis directs. Yeah, and so they held a 2-day conference looking at this idea of why are we limiting ourselves to just a biological or racially essentialized definition? And then a more contemporary writer, Thomas Williams, contemporary usage of descriptors like Black and white, drenched as they are in non-science, mostly just get in the way. For Murray, African Americans, those people whose culture is truly indigenous to the U.S., incorporate all the essential identities and experiences within themselves and exemplify the fundamentally mongrel nature of the land. Okay. I just love that. And he has these statistics about what the average African American might be, what, 18% white, right? So what does it mean to be Black, like in that way, right? You know. These are just symbolic, I guess. So I actually got to the last slide. Okay. So I'm going to also like Dick quote from Galatians 3. In Christ, you're all sons of God through faith. Many of you were baptized into Christ, put on Christ, neither Jew, Greek, slave, free, male, female, all one. And if you're a Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring. So that's the part I really, now it just pops out to me because I, after my own study on this idea of the Abraham covenant, you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise.